Just a quick note before we get started. I had an amazing conversation with John Devlin, who's the author and illustrator of the True Color books on football kits. We covered a lot of ground, and we didn't even cover everything that I wanted to talk about. I want to let you know that I'm creating a companion post on my blog, soccernomad.wordpress.com, that has all the notes and images of the items that we talked about. Again, you can find that on my blog, soccernomad.wordpress.com. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. This is the Soccer Nomad podcast. On this episode, I'm joined by John Devlin. John, how are things?
Yeah, not too bad, Austin. Nice to speak to you.
Yes. So for those of you who don't know, John is the person to go to regarding kits. When I found out that there's actually a, a hashtag kit nerd thing happening, and I started listening to different podcasts, Football Addict, whatnot, John's name always came up. So I made contact with him on Twitter. We've been trading things back and forth. He's been kind enough to read a couple things for me. So I want to have him on the podcast to kind of go over general kit terms. So John is the author of True Colors, football kits from 1980 to the present day. You did two volumes of these. He runs the True Colors website, which can be found at truecolorsfootballkits.com, and is a guest on several kit podcasts, including Design Football and, like I mentioned, the Football Attic. So John, let's start with the books. Talk a little bit about what's in each book and how you went about putting these volumes together.
Right, yeah, no problem. It was a dream of mine since I was a small boy, and I still have little felt tip drawings of kits that I did when I was about 8 or 9. And I always wanted to see a book that pulled together all the shirts, all the kits that clubs had ever worn. That was my dream. And every year I'd go to the bookshops in England and look, and nothing ever came out. And it suddenly hit me when I was at college doing graphic design, studying for a graphic design degree, that I thought, do you know what? It's got to be me. I'm the person that has to do this. So that was kind of my spur, and pulled in all my resources that I had. And I've got a great collection of programs, catalogues, magazines, sketches that I'd made all through my life, really. And I wanted to be that first person to say, okay, let's really document what every team has worn. Not just the home and away shirts, but the ones that were worn on a wet Tuesday evening just once, and the real rarities as well. So that was my dream, and 10 years ago, I was lucky enough to get it published and get it out there.
Yeah, so the pages feature a graphic of the entire strip, the years worn, manufacturer, and sponsor. You do put a little bit about the design and some key moments and players. So, like I said, there's two volumes. They cover specific teams, so make sure you check the volumes for that. But sort of talk about how Volume 1 came about, and then like how you decided the teams for Volume 2.
Yeah, sure. Well, with Volume 1, I wrote off to several publishers. I bought a book with publishers' addresses in it, and one of the first ones to come back were one called A&C Black, who are based in Soho in London. And they said, we love the concept, but we need approval. We need copyright and intellectual property approval from every single logo you've got in the book. And they wanted to feature the Premier League teams of that season that was going to come out, which in the end was 2005, 2006. So prior to that, though, of course, it took me nearly 2 years to clear every single logo. So I wrote to every sponsor, every manufacturer, and of course, every club, and said, can I reproduce your IP in the book? Fortunately, only two people rejected them. A couple of sponsors weren't able to do that, but everyone else was fine with it. So all systems go. And of course, the publishers for maximum sales wanted the Premier League sides of that time. They felt they could market it as those 20 clubs. So that was Volume 1, really. Volume 2, a year later, sort of followed up. The first one was a great success. The publishers were delighted with it and said, let's continue. I had plenty of other teams already done, and it was a case of just expanding on them and putting in the home international sides, England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, and the Republic of Ireland. And then there was Volume 2. So it was very much guided by the publishers what teams they wanted. but I had all the material. And apart from a last minute panic where I think Wigan Athletic were promoted and I had nothing for Wigan, and I had like a 2 week turnaround where I had to research and write everything that they'd worn since 1980, that was my only real panic.
Yeah, like I said, you can find pages, sample pages on John's website, so I encourage you to check them out. These books are definitely, on my wish list, and I'm hoping to get them soon. Any thoughts on updating the books or future projects, anything like that?
Definitely. It's very, very early days. It's something I've been looking at for some time. And I'm in the process now of looking at seriously updated volumes with more clubs, more teams, sorry, more clubs, more kits, more years, and even things like goalkeeper shirts and tracksuits as well, things like that that are on the kind of periphery of football match wear. But it's really those clearances again. That's my main kind of stumbling block, is that you have to get everything has to be done properly. So you need to go through certain legal procedures, and that's always a thing that takes time. But I'm fingers crossed it's all systems go from me. So I'm working on those at the moment.
Okay, we'll definitely look forward to those. Let's move on to a sort of kit 101. Many listeners hear you and guests on other podcasts talk about kits and shadow printing and turnover socks and all these terms, and I thought we'd take a little time and break all those down.
No problem.
So the strip or kit. So in America, everything's uniforms or jerseys, and a couple years ago I found the hashtag kit nerd, and now, as you know, it's a big part of my life. In terms of definition for association football, the kit or strip or soccer uniform is a standard equipment and attire worn by players. How are those two terms used in design circles?
Well, really, I mean, the kit, from my perspective, always refers to shirt, shorts, socks, but I guess it could extend out to, as you say, pre-match warm-up, training wear, shin pads, boots. There's everything that goes into that, and of course you've got several kind of, I think they brand it as stages in match day wear now, where you've got the pre-match warm build up, the match itself, and then the aftermatch where they'll put on something else. But kit and strip essentially mean the same thing. I think the terms go in and out of fashion over the years. It's an interchangeable term really, but I really like uniform as well. I mean, we don't use that so much in the UK, but I do bring it in sometimes in my writing because it's quite an appropriate term.
Okay, so the laws of the game set out the basic equipment, which must be worn by all players in Law 4. So it lists five separate items: the shirt, also known as the jersey, shorts, socks, also known as stockings, which I didn't know, and footwear and shin pads. So we're going to stay clear of footwear and shin pads. But
All
let's
good.
touch on socks for a second. They used to be called stockings. They used to be dark for the longest time, which I found out. I always wondered why Everton and Manchester United had dark socks when it seemed like dark, sort of red, black, black, or red, white, or in Everton's case, blue, white, always seemed to be the way to go. But I guess I had to do something with fabric in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, I find socks really fascinating, and they can become a real focus for the kit nerd. You really start looking at them. I've always been under the impression that in the early days of football, when you look back at the Victorian times, everything was done from a practical point of view. So I would imagine that black socks were more common than any other type of socks. So in some respects, the classic football kit uniform in those days was a white shirt, black knickerbockers, as they were probably known then, which were very, very long shorts, and black stockings. That's almost like the standard workwear. Do you know what I mean? It's that kind of, borrowed from the street, as it were. But of course, white socks are generally regarded as better than black. Several managers over the years have become very superstitious over white socks, and I think it helps players pick other players out on the pitch more.
Okay.
So I always find that quite interesting, and I always think the kit's primary function has to make sure that the two teams are separate and that you recognise your own teammates. So any design elements that can be brought in to assist with that is makes perfect sense to me. So hence white socks are very popular.
Absolutely. So we'll probably touch on that concept in a little bit. So staying with socks for just one more moment. Turnovers is a term that I guess I had always known what they were and did. I just never gave them a name, but it's sort of when you pull the sock all the way up and then you sort of flip over the top that creates, either a contrast or maybe there's some sort of design element. Talk about that real quick.
Yeah, well it's a lovely way to get a bit of colour in there, and it's a way to, extend your colours onto the socks. I guess when socks were again looking at functional usage, maybe they were too long and they were rolled down in order to become a more manageable length. I do believe there's an organic design process that goes on there, but it's a great way to get extra colour and pattern into the design.
Okay, so let's move on to the shirts. I was reading historical football kits put together a really good brief history of football kit design, and they mentioned something that you just talked about, which is in essence the original jerseys were, like you said, like white shirts, usually some sort of cricket whites is what they called it, and they would wear some sort of cap or sash or something that would sort of show the difference between each teams. And like you said, it was very functional. This is what they had. They didn't have like an anthem jacket and pre-game and post-game wear. They just had what they had.
Imagine if you did though, Austin. Wouldn't that be something? Yeah.
like you said, it's just something to distinguish the two teams. I found a video on a Manchester United Reddit feed of a game from 1902 against Burnley. It's in black and white. In essence, they're wearing the same shorts, and they both teams wear white shorts. But because of the black and white, it's really hard to tell the difference between the shorts, excuse me, between the socks and the shirts. Obviously, they could tell the difference, but it's just interesting that basically the shirts were the difference between the two teams.
Yeah, that's right. I think again you're looking at the practical growth and development of football and realizing as you go what needs to change in order, the form follows function kind of ethos of design, that the kits then mutated and changed into a way that they were fit for purpose. It's kind of what's happening now with technology as well, but especially so back then.
Yeah. So, as the game developed and clubs become, more organized, more professional, teams started incorporating particular colors and designs. Now, one book that's in my collection so far is Picking Up the Threads, by John Chandler, and he has a page in his book that talks about shirt style. So I just wanted to touch on these real quick. Obviously you have vertical and horizontal stripes. The horizontals are commonly referred to as hoops. Pinstripes were added. You kind of have the sleeves, which for listeners is sort of like the, if you think of Arsenal, the red chest with the white sleeves. You have the sash, which probably in the last 5 years has really emerged as a design element. I think you would agree. And then he has yoke, and there's chevron or V. One thing that I came across was he gave the name halved. To sort of a jersey that is, half and half. We were talking before we recorded about Newton Heath and Manchester United, the green and gold halved shirt, and then the sleeves alternate. So it's, for the technical definition, that is a halved shirt. I thought that was really interesting. And then the quartered shirt, which is, if you can imagine, four quarters, two colors each on a jersey. I was trying to rack my brain. I want to say it's like Bristol Rovers is the only. I don't know if that's the right team, but there's like
Yeah, that is. And I think Wycombe Wanderers maybe as well.
okay.
I think they're the two that spring to mind. But it's funny though. I mean, a lot of those terms, a lot of these designs, again, you're going to go right back to the origins of football for the halved shirts, the stripes, the hoops, the quarters, the sashes. They're all very, very early, very, very early football kit design elements that are reappropriated in the modern day. And of course, the sash now is it harks right back to those early days when a coloured sash that was physically tied onto the shirt was the only way to tell the teams apart. So it's really fun to look at those designs. Hoops, of course, come primarily in rugby, and stripes primarily in football. That's a general rule of thumb. I guess with rugby, the hoops make the players look wider and bigger and more formidable. And in football, the stripes make them look faster, maybe. I'm sure there's reasons behind that, but that's always been my understanding.
Yep, that sentiment was echoed in the materials I read as well. One jersey that's on there is the Ajax shirt. Now, this made total sense to me. Ajax has got this big band of a contrasting color down the middle, and then the outside colors are the same. Theirs is red, white, excuse me, white, and then red in the middle, then white on the outside. I really felt that Crystal Palace echoed that echoed that look this year with their home shirts. And
Yeah.
PSG is kind of gone there lately. Maybe not the thick knit band in the middle. In America, it's sort of if you think of the Philadelphia Union, they have the
Yeah.
midnight blue on the outside and the khaki in the middle. Again, theirs isn't their strip down the middle is not nearly as thick as probably at Ajax, but it's that sort of idea.
I think what you're looking at there is it's as football developed, and I think the Ajax one is, it's not that old, that strip design relatively, but it's coming from people thinking, okay, let's make ourselves look different here. Let's bring some identity and some brand into the team, which I think is massively important and is something that's in danger of being eroded with modern design. The idea that, you can recognize at a glance what an Ajax shirt is. But of course, then you do find that teams like Crystal Palace, for example, are influenced by that. And, you can go right back to the origins of football again and find teams being inspired by other teams to wear their colours. Nottingham Forest, Arsenal's red shirts came from Nottingham Forest. So there's always been a kind of envious looking over at other sides and thinking, oh, I like what they're wearing. Can we borrow that? But also this concept of making themselves look unique, which is really important, isn't it, I think, in football.
Yeah, in this book, Picking Up the Threads, he does John Chandler does an evolution and talks about how, if you start with Nottingham Forest, he goes all the way to SC Braga, Rotherham United, Arsenal sort of the link there, the white shirts of Real Madrid, how that was picked up by Leeds,
Of course,
and so, J.R. Francis, who's a regular guest on the pod, the Manchester City red and black away strip is picked up from a friendly with AC Milan. He
That's
really
correct.
hates that, but that's where it comes from. And it's kind of cool how teams sort of see something and then over time incorporate. You read my draft of claret and blue. And I appreciate
Yes.
that. And it's Aston Villa for whatever reason picks that color combination and it trickles down. And all of a sudden, 1970 something Trabzonspor in Turkey is formed. And excuse me, 1960 Trabzonspor is formed in Turkey. And they're wearing it. And it's this is from the 1800s. It's just that's what Aston Villa picked. And
That's right.
it still trickles down today.
And it's fun, it's interesting when you look, and so many of these early colour choices are steeped in mystery. Nobody really knows why certain clubs wore what they wore. Sometimes it's the chairman's university colours, or it could be the racing colour, the horse racing colours. There's all sorts of origins where they come from, and it's really great when someone discovers old documents that say, ah, this is the definitive reason why whoever wore whatever, it's quite it's a good detective work, good detective job, I think.
Yeah, so that segues into sort of design itself. Originally the shirts were really heavy, and but again, it's practicality. That's what they had to wear. In the 1950s, it starts changing, and why don't you just take it from there, sort of in terms of the material and maybe some of the design elements that came about.
Yeah, well, I think in the 50s you started to see, and there's a famous thing that I know we've talked about as well with Bolton wearing a shiny kit in the 53 FA Cup final. And of course, you began to see that with floodlights coming into play. Nighttime matches, more reflective material, shiny material was used then because they felt they illuminated better under floodlights. So again, you're seeing a very practical reasons for the designs. Of course, high street fashion takes over as well, or whatever fashion existed back in those days, and you start to see how teams would change and fabrics would change. And that's when things began to get interesting. But there's always the great story of England playing Hungary in a friendly, I think it was, and Hungary absolutely thrashed them. And a lot of people put it down to the fact that they had very lightweight kits. They didn't wear the heavy old cotton that England were wearing. They were wearing slinky, more practical kits for use. And there's a very funny story. A couple of England players were about to kick off, and they looked over, and apparently one said to the other, "We're going to be right here, mate." He said, "Look at them, they haven't even got the right gear," because possibly typical English arrogance, thinking they're the ones with the right stuff. And of course, Hungary then go and run rings around them. That then became the origins of, very lightweight shirts, short sleeves, V-necks, and away you go.
Yeah, talk about sort of what the lightweight shirts do and the wicking and all those technological elements real quick.
Yeah, well, that's something that's become more and more prevalent, and every single press release for a shirt now, as I'm sure you've seen, always stresses how much more percentage of sweat these shirts can wick. Technology is driving football kit design. It's debatable how much difference they actually make. Some people say, yeah, there's studies where you can feel the weight of the shirt is noticeably different, but at the moment shirts are all about lightweight, so badges are applied in a certain way that adds no weight to the fabric. So rather than having heavy old embroidered crests, they're lightweight, heat press transfers. It's all about keeping weight off, and that's what players want. They want to feel completely comfortable, and as the game goes on, not burdened down by sweat-sodden shirts, as it were.
Yeah, a couple years ago, I got the Holland Away, the authentic, and I think that was the first time I had ponied up the money. Well, I got a really good deal on it, but I ponied up
Okay.
the money, and like you said, it really is different. Like you mentioned, it's the manufacturer's logo and the crest is transferred. It's not embroidered. The material is it does it is different. Yesterday, actually, I was at a store and I got to see the authentic and the replica Manchester United uniforms side by side.
Okay.
And what else? My son was with me, and of course, I was getting ready for this, and I'm sort of a kit nerd, so I explained it to him, of course. And I said, feel the difference in the fabric, the replica, the sort of fans version. It's a little bit heavy. It's a little more robust because if you're wearing the game 38 times and washing it, that's got to hold up. The same thing for the badge; those have to hold up. Whereas you look at the authentic, it's very slim. I could see the crest, peeling or cracking over time if you put that in the washer and dryer every week. But I got to see the back. Adidas has done their venting for the latest shirts is there's a several holes down the back, down the spine, and spaced out through the back, and you could see it side by side. It really is cool. I mean, there is definitely technology. I'm sure there is a difference, as like you said, if you wear like a heavy cotton shirt till polyester till whatever this dry tech Climacool stuff is, it really is a difference. It's really interesting.
That's right, and I think that's the most extreme example. What some commentators would say is when they get to the nth degree, how much difference do these new ones make when they claim that they wick 20% more sweat? You can think, well, actually, crikey, the shirts are going to be, they'll be weighing less than nothing soon, So I think that's kind of possibly where some people are a little sort of skeptical about it. But it's funny when you talk about the heat transfer badges. When I was growing up in the 70s, replica shirts had really crummy kind of transfers and little felt things that peeled off after one or two washes, and the match worn shirts were embroidered thick badges. And of course now it's completely the other way around, where they're giving replicas value by having a nicely embroidered badge, and it's the players that are wearing the heat transfers. So it's funny how it's turned on its head now.
Absolutely. So, printing elements is another thing I wanted to talk to you about. Kind of a point of reference in some of the materials I read was Tottenham Hotspurs used a shadow stripe in the early 80s.
Yeah,
And
one of the first.
when I was Rich Johnson was on the pod, I remember like in the I want to say the mid 70s, another element was the tram line shirt for Coventry City. Sort of talk about like those two elements in particular, maybe more generally what's happened in the last 20, 30 years.
Well, of course, Admiral came along in the early 70s, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute. It completely revolutionised the way football shirt design went. By bringing in more coloured panels. So rather than, you've got this period of the late 60s, early 70s, where teams are wearing one colour, and we've had that recently in international football, one colour strips. But it was going on back then. It was it, and there was no contrasting trim or anything. It was just one colour shirts. Admiral then started putting panels and stripes and yokes and tram lines. And of course, these were, from my understanding, separate bits of fabric. So they were stitched on. They were, rough seams. They were uncomfortable. In the 80s, things became even more modern, even more technology driven. And Spurs shirt, the shadow stripes, lovely. I mean, it's one of my most favorite kind of football kit adornments of the shadow stripes. And that comes from what they call a jacquard fabric. And it's down to the weave, how the loom weaves it in a way that gives that kind of two-tone texture. So that was, again, a technology thing. And of course, now you've got sublimated dyes, which is another way of getting complex patterns and designs onto shirts without adding extra fabric and extra weight. So again, it's as clothes apparel production improves, the design follows.
So jacquard's a term that's out there. So I think you gave a definition of what that means. What's an example of like a sublimated dye, either in past jerseys or in current?
Well, you'd see that certainly in the early 90s with the way that the kind of really outrageous patterns like we saw flex like Norwich City shirt, for example, that would be a sublimated dye on there. And rugby is very big for that as well, because they have lots of logos as well. And it's the most effective, cost-effective way and weight-effective way to get all these logos and crests and badges onto the shirt is to effectively, it's almost like, I guess it's like painting them on, isn't it, in a way? And that's so that they're good examples of how sublimation is driving football shirt design at the moment.
Okay, some other terms is shadow printing, pinstripes. Talk about sort of what those are and examples of those.
Yeah, well, shadow stripes we talked about with Spurs, and they started off as vertical, and then they became horizontal, and then they became diagonal, and again, and then they became more complex. And then by the early 80s, and Umbro really pioneered this, you started to see very complex shadow patterns or jacquard patterns, very geometric, often in Umbro's case, taken from their diamond shape, a very geometric logo, perfectly balanced, pulling out designs and pulling out features of that. That's a great example there. Pinstripes, I've always believed, now someone can may prove me wrong on this, I think they came from American baseball, from baseball jerseys way back. That's my always been my perception of where they came from. And again, it was a really nice way to start adorning shirts, patterning shirts, but without compromising the colour integrity, if that makes sense. So you could say, okay, you've got Ipswich Town, a plain blue shirt, white pinstripes, you're adding a bit of oomph to it. There's a bit of elegance there, but it's not taking away from the fact that it's a blue shirt. So it's a very clever way of doing that. And it's no surprise really that pinstripes and shadow stripes are very much back in fashion again. And I don't think they'll ever go out of fashion. I think they'll reappear on a regular cycles. So yeah, I mean, they're the two that really drove the kind of 80s kit revolution, as it were.
So when I started following football, Manchester United had the red shirts with the laces, and then the following two seasons, 94 to 96, they had a red shirt with sort of a wrapped collar, and Old Trafford was somehow printed into the shirt. And that was a very 90s thing. Like, what is the technology? What is the definition? How does that all work? How do they do that?
Oh, crikey. Do you know what? I won't lie. I could easily sit here and pretend I know that. I'm not so sure. I'm not sure. I would imagine, again, it's a dye sublimation. So it's a very simple way of putting that on there. A United shirt collector might be able to clear that up. I think if I had one in front of me, I could probably work that out. But I think that's where that comes from. So I think you had a period there where people were dyeing and sublimating shirts and using a jacquard. So you're getting almost three levels of pattern, three levels of design. But I know the shirt you mean very well, and I'd imagine it is a sublimated design there.
It seems like some of the 90s design elements are coming back. I really think about Chelsea's home shirt. It's got the blue. It's if you look at it from far away, it's a blue shirt with a white collar, but obviously everyone's talking about sort of the lions inside of it. And there's a couple other teams that are maybe going back to the 90s. Are you seeing that, or
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's something I lose a lot of sleep over, Austin, as well, is that I think that every year, every decade, you see technology driving design, kit design. And I think we're at a stage now where possibly the design, the technology is driving the weight of the shirts and everything else and fabric and that, but it's not really pushing the design that much forward. And I think what's happening is people, designers with a one season turnaround, are having to look back much sooner than perhaps they should be for influence, for pattern, for adornment on the shirts. So you're seeing a real kind of like potpourri of shadow stripes, pinstripes, sashes, patterns, repeated badge patterns, as we see with Chelsea, as you rightly say. It almost feels like all these things have come from technology in the past, and yet you might be wondering, well, okay, well, what's the new technology that's going to drive shirts forward now and stop them kind of regurgitating what's already gone? But it's an interesting, we're at a very interesting state in the football design evolution, I think.
It's interesting that you talk about how designers are going back. We have a listener question that we're going to get to in a little bit, and we'll come back to that. So some other terms I wrote down were trim, piping, tape, hem. Why don't you talk about those and maybe any other terms or concepts that, listeners should be looking out for?
Well, if, yeah, any trim is something that we would refer to as any coloured adornment on the shirt. So piping's a great example. That first really came in probably, yeah, 81, 82, something like that. Umbro were great pioneers of that, as they were with most football kit design. And it's just like a little, it's almost like a little rib of fabric almost. So it's quite, it's, I guess it's quite heavy really, relatively. And it's just a thin line, and it can go normally from sort of neck to shoulder or down the arm or, you know, something like that. And can be used to highlight panels down the side of the shirts, because we, when we talked about mesh fabric, tea bag fabric, that the kind of are used under the arms, where the areas where you sweat more, little piping was often used to kind of highlight those areas. So again, you're picking out the areas that are different. And of course, we talked about taping. Taping was something that's, you know, typically 70s really, pioneered by Admiral in the main. And taping really just describes a contrasting piece of fabric that runs down the shoulder from neck to cuff of a shirt and down the side of the shorts. Quite often it will feature a repeated pattern of the manufacturer's logo, as the case with Umbro and Admiral. And then of course in Adidas's case, they've got the classic three-stripe trim, which is, you know, trademarked now like their logo. So brilliant branding device. I mean, absolutely brilliant. But that's again something that's never going to go away. It's, you know, that taping is a great way to decorate a football shirt. And I think comes from almost a military uniform application from hundreds of years ago. I think you can see elements of things like that being used in costumes back then.
Okay. Anything else that maybe, any other terms that maybe we should talk about real quick?
Well, I think we've covered quite a lot, haven't we? So
Yeah.
yeah, I think that's, yeah, a good summary.
Okay, so one item of interest for me is collars. I'm a big, I like the collar, like sort of the fold over collar. I do like those. But when I was looking at terms, we have crew neck, we have V-neck, we have stub. We have one thing that you guys talk about on Football Addict and Design Football is the Henley or Grandad collar. There's all these sorts of collars. Once you kind of, and as we've learned, they collars that look the same have different names. Why don't you sort of talk about sort of basic collars and stuff that might be more a little more intricate?
Right. Well, I mean, we can trace collar evolution again through the years. So, as a rule of thumb, 50s, very deep plunging V-necks. Prior to the 50s, it was all proper old-fashioned cotton collars with button-up plackets. And the placket is the kind of strip of fabric that runs down the center of the shirt where the buttons are, where you button them up. In the 60s, it was crew necks. So again, very long sleeve crew necks. In the 70s, you began to get wing collars, you know, big, big collars that took the V-neck, added a collar on top, and you've got a classic sportswear design. In the 80s, it was almost definitely solely V-necks before wrap-over crew necks came in and wrap-over V-necks. And then back at the late 80s, early 90s, you've got the return of the old-fashioned collar again. They then mutated very quickly, as I'm sure you're aware, if you look at the early 90s, from a straightforward button-up press stud collar, and often press studs on the actual lapels as well, which is always quite nice. they then become even more complicated with folds and intricate piping and pointy bits. And, it's almost like they mutated themselves. And then towards the end of the 90s, you began to get very slick, minimal collars, which have almost like reduced crew necks, if you like, with inserts in the middle. Again, you're looking at reducing weight. Players like to have their necks free. I don't think they like button up or high crew necks. They like to have breathing space around their neck, and shirts reflected that. So quite often they would almost be hemmed, and that would be it. There'd be no proper neck design as such. And now we're in a state where it's a mixture of everything. You see all sorts of different designs. It's a very kind of postmodern approach to collars. But like you though, Austin, I think the collar is the real cornerstone of the shirt, and I think that almost in a way defines where the shirt design is going to go. And it's the best way to make each design look really different. And having a contrasting collar where the collar is a different color to the shirt, or a self-contrasting collar where a self collar where it's the same. So these are very important ways to start really making each shirt look unique and special.
So ones I wanted to touch on, and maybe they'll lead to coverage of collars per se, is for me one of my favorite Manchester United shirts is the 12-13 away shirt. It's a white jersey and it's got this red trim, but it's got buttons and it sort of folds over itself. I have no idea what the kind of collar is, but I love it.
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of echoed in this year's Stoke. Away, Macron used a light blue, and then they have this white piece that covers the buttons and sort of this ring collar. I really, is there a name for that? Is that, it
Well,
doesn't seem common, but I don't know.
as we looked at this and we talked about it before, there's a term that comes up in rugby collar design, the Kiwi collar that we mentioned. I think you're looking at a kind of Kiwi collar there. In the United case that you mentioned, it's very minimal. It's almost like again, it's like a baseball jersey collar, is it not? It's that the way that it curves and wraps around, but with a placket there as well, with buttons there as well.
Yeah,
But
I just like how the buttons are covered so you can't see them. I really like that touch.
I think a lot of these shirts at the moment, they need to have a dual purpose. One is they need to be fit for use on the pitch. They need to do a job on the pitch, but also they need to be saleable as replicas. So it's almost those little touches there. It's all about giving a nice bit of value to the replica buying public as well, and that's what gives them a dual need, if you like.
So going back a little farther to around the mid-90s, I have the Spain home shirt from Euro 96, which I has buttons, and then the collar I believe is this Henley collar that I refer to. Am I right on that? I think another example would be Newcastle from the same time.
Oh, the button up, the round neck, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I always refer to that as a granddad collar because that comes from a kind of an English, like the traditional old-fashioned shirts, like a three-button shirt, if you like. But that's often referred to as a granddad collar. But I've known it called a stub collar as well. So yeah, I know exactly the one you mean.
Okay, and then wrapping up with something a little more modern, Iceland's jersey this year at Euro 2016 was very interesting. I don't even know if I can describe it, but it's round around the neck, but then it goes into a wide V with an insert. It's very interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah, no, very
How do
much.
you how would you describe that? Is it What do you think it's doing?
Oh, it would take me several paragraphs, I think, to write about that one. It's a hybrid, isn't it? I guess in a way, it's a hybrid of a. I don't know what it is, Austin, if I'm honest. There's a lot of stuff going on there, but again, it's all about keeping weight down, I guess, and giving a nice open neck. But it's quite convoluted in a way. I think the Norwich third shirt's similar, isn't it? This season, I think that's the same kind of design as well.
Yeah, the
So,
sort of white bird poop jersey.
yeah.
That, but yeah, their collar's interesting too. It's similar but different. It's very, again, it's round like on the neck, but then it opens up into this V, and has a little notch to keep everything in place. It's really interesting. It's
And
very intricate, like you said.
it's not a million miles away from a Kappa design that came out. I think it was last season, where they have a little raised, almost like a little raised collar at the back as well, because there's the neck part of it, and then of course there's the collar part that kind of sticks up a little bit. So it really is a hybrid design, I think.
So we've gone through all these elements, there's cuffs, there's hems, there's all this other stuff. But in your mind, what makes the ideal kit, or is there such a thing?
I think there is. For me, I mean, I always stick by this. I think it's a mixture of heritage, tradition, and contemporary. As much as I like retro shirts, I don't think they're the way. It sounds obvious, really, when I say it. They're not the way forward. You know, shirts need to reflect where we're at this time in society, on the pitch, in football, in the world, in fashion. But also, they've got to be loyal to the identity of the club. I think that's the mixture. It's the mix of traditional identity and contemporary application of it. That's the key element for a good kit design, in my view. And I don't know if football kits have evolved in terms of construction, other than lightweight wicking fabric, as much as they should have done. I've spoken to designers fairly recently, frustrated at, trying to do all-in-one designs that have been rejected and things like that. I think the rules, the people that rule football, can be quite strict on what's allowed and what can happen in the football kit world.
So you were part of the guys who did the greatest football 50 greatest football shirts ever. Real quick, was there one that was your favorite, or when you I know you guys that you submitted 50 or so, but was there one that you were like number one with a bullet, I will fight tooth and nail for?
One of my all-time favorite shirts is the Newcastle one you mentioned earlier, the Adidas Grandad jersey one from about 95, I think, and probably one of the last times that Newcastle wore a really traditional uninterrupted black and white stripe combo. That's a real beauty, and that was just wonderful. But one of my favorite shirts was the I'm a Scotland fan. One of my favorite shirts is the Scotland late 80s, early 90s Umbro shirt. I thought, I mean, as a touch of elegance and the innovation that went into that design, it's a key shirt that's often overlooked. But that was one that I fought tooth and nail and really threw my toys out the pram if that one wasn't going to be included.
Yeah, the Scotland one that you mentioned finished, I think, 25th. It was 1988 to 91, and the Newcastle one ended up, that was top 10, yeah, 8th, 95 to 97 home shirts.
And the funny that Newcastle one as well, the away shirt was almost as good, if not better in some ways. The maroon and navy hooped jersey with not white but like an off-white, a cream Adidas 3 trim and Grandad collar, beautifully done. And the sponsors' logos integrated so well into the design, perfect stuff.
Oh, that's we will not talk about that because that would take us off on a super tangent. So let's wrap up with some audience questions. I reached out on Twitter and Facebook, and I got some really good, interesting questions. I got a question from Leighton Castle, who's at Leighton Castle on Twitter. He said, "Whatever happened to Henson, who made the Villa kits in the mid-80s? Do you know that? Do you know the answer to that?"
I do. Henson were actually, I think, partly owned by the club themselves back then. And certainly I found this out because when I approached the club for clearances when I did my books, they were able to give permission for the Henson kits because they owned that brand. Whether they still do, I don't know. But Henson are still a going concern. They're an Icelandic company, but they're still going, producing not just football apparel, but all manner of sports. So I think, yeah, if you Google Henson Sportswear, I think you'll find them.
Okay, Curtis Jenkins, who's a leader of one of the supporter groups here in Atlanta, he has more. He has a very pressing question. He says, "Does he have the? Do you have the address of the person who designed the zebra stripes for Juve's third shirt this year?"
No. I quite like that.
Oh, you do?
I think it's again, it's what's the word? It's bold, it's brave, it's courageous. There's got to be a little bit of courage in the design, so I don't mind it.
So there's two things that I'm thinking about on the Adidas third shirts this year. One is, Chris Oakley talked about on a recent Football Addict podcast that there's a purpose to a third jersey, and You can take chances, and so people should not be so critical. And I thought that was an interesting point of view. I talked about a little bit with JR on the English Premier League preview, but okay, so that if you take that for what it's worth, I get you there. The second thing is, I think Adidas has used something on their jerseys. Like last year was these shorts, like with interesting designs, and I say interesting as a way to say bad.
I see. So.
Juve, Chelsea, Manchester United, these shorts that looked crap. And this year it seems to be on the sleeves, like Juve uses the zebra, Manchester United has this B hexagon thing. But again, if they are taking chances and, like you say, be bold, maybe it's not so bad.
Sometimes they'll win and sometimes they won't. I like to use the word challenging for it.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether I like it or not. I think there's a danger. We had this trend of conceptual kits, so kits that had a real meaning behind them, and sometimes they can be quite convoluted. I think, yeah, some of these work. I think you've got to be bold, but again, if you read the subtext of a lot of these designs are out there to cause controversy, to get publicity, and I won't name who does them, but every now and again you'll see a design that's so challenging, it creates a massive buzz, massive publicity. So that's a very cynical, but it does happen. Very cynical way of marketing replica shirts.
Staying along with that, one question I see here is Alberto asks, what's your favorite ugly kit? Now, sometimes, like you said, they're actually designed that way to create the buzz. But what's a kit that, maybe people think that's ugly or that you think is really good? He references the Jamaica kit from World Cup 98. But what are some, that appears on the worst of list, but you really like?
But without a doubt, it's the Hull City first Tiger shirt. They had two different styles of Tiger shirt. The first one was, oh crikey, is it 89, I think? Match winner made them. And of course, it had an all over Tiger print. Massive uproar at the time, but you look at it now and think, well, do you know what? That's spot on. It represents the club. What a wonderful way to do it. I think it looks great and it has real design meaning behind it. I think it's that's without a doubt my favorite ugly. I've got plenty of ugly designs I really can't bear, but that's one that I love.
Okay, you referenced technology and how technology is driving kit design and that sort of thing. Aaron Nobles asked, who designs all the Nike kits? And I think you and Jay had a really interesting conversation on, I wrote it down here, episode 12 of the Design Football Podcast. You use the England kit as a starting point for a discussion about technology and design. Why don't you talk about how the reason why everyone's wearing the vapor and why maybe that's not a good thing or is a good thing, that sort of discussion real
Okay,
quick.
the reason why they're wearing it, I can't tell you, because I don't know. I'm trying to find out. I know a few people at Nike, and I really want to get to the bottom of their thinking with this shirt, because there's a clear strategy here, isn't there, in what they're doing, that every single one of their teams is wearing this vapor template. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. I don't know, because I'm in conflict about it myself. Sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't. I can see the methodology is there, although quite what it is, I'm not sure. I know that sounds contradictory, but it's a real difficult one. It's the fact that they're using these contrasting short socks colours as well. That really throws, that's another element into the mix. My main concern about it is the fact that it's a manufacturer imposing their identity, possibly stronger than the clubs itself. And I think that's the danger. I think clubs' identity is the most key thing, the most important thing about a shirt. And when a manufacturer starts to overshadow that, I think there's an imbalance of power. So that's something that I would like to find out more about. And hopefully I will do and can, get to the bottom of what this thinking is about.
Well, and J.R. Francis asked that question too, is what's your position on a team on who fans should blame when a kit manufacturer runs roughshod over a team's standards, colors, and history?
I think it's almost certainly the manufacturers. I think you'll get instances where sponsors may determine colours, but in the main, it's manufacturers, and it's their concept, it's their agenda. And I think clubs fall in line with that. Obviously, approvals have to be given, but unless you're a fly on the wall in these discussions, I don't know how that would work. I mean, I know the guy who presents to the England team for their kits. And so, it has to go through certain levels of the hierarchy, and the manager has to say, yeah, we're going to wear that. And of course, as a graphic designer myself, I know that clients don't always buy my concepts. They may say, no, we want to keep it this way. And it's interesting, you kind of wonder how far designs have gone that have been rejected before clubs are persuaded. But I think that's the key thing is to I'd like to see kits being worn for longer than a season. I think you've got to give a bit more value to people there. And I think it's too quick. Design isn't growing naturally, organically. It's almost being forced, and as we talked about earlier, regurgitating old ideas rather than a fluid, modernistic approach of gradual development. So, the manufacturers are calling the shots, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, so there's a lot of good stuff in that last response, and we will definitely have to talk about that on a future podcast. But several people asked about how soon is too soon to go back to the past. Is it 20 years? Is it 30 years? Is it 100 years? A couple examples would be, the Norwich third kit is referencing one of their first Premier League kits, that sort of yellow with the green specks. I know Everton's away shirt this year, I mean, it's like from the 1890s is what it's referencing. What is too soon? What is too long? What is the right balance, if there is one?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we've seen a few of those. Everton, obviously, with Le Coq Sportif, they, a few years back now, was it just before the Nike deal? They then went back and looked at their early 80s shirt with the classic Le Coq Sportif crew neck with a very deep white insert. I don't think there's the hard and fast rule. I think if it's applied well and it's considered and it's made original, I think you can be influenced by colours, sure. At any point, and I think teams should have color palettes. I think that's all part of their identity again. I know I keep hammering that home, but that's massively important to me that clubs have their identity, their brand. But I don't like to see shirts repeated exactly as before. I mean, even you'll be aware of this, the Man United shirt of last year. At first glance, that looked like an early 80s shirt, and it was a little bit too close to cut for comfort for me. I'd like to see something a bit more original, have hints of that feel, that look and feel, but don't copy it per se. I think that's the danger. So, but you've got to leave it sometime. It's like music, though, isn't it, as well? You've got to leave it sometime before you start releasing cover versions of songs. So I think there's a natural period, but it's all down to each individual case.
Okay, well that's perfect. I want to thank everyone who reached out with their questions. We didn't get to them all, so we will save them for another time. But John, I just want to thank you for taking some time out of your day. I really appreciate all of your wisdom and expertise and knowledge. Why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you and any upcoming projects that you have?
Yeah, thank you. The website, as you said, is truecolorsfootballkits.com. It's in the process of a bit of a relaunch, so there's going to be a new design up there hopefully fairly soon. Twitter at truecolorskits. There's a Facebook page as well. But if anyone wants to talk kits, anyone got any kits projects they want to work on? I've done lots of different stuff that I'm always up for any kit work. John@truecolorsfootballkits.com. Get in touch and let me know. We've got lots of ideas going on at the moment. There's an Admiral documentary coming out very soon that I'm in, which is going to be absolutely fabulous. It's a real history of Admiral and the replica shirt. So any projects like that, if you just want to talk kits, drop me a line. Always glad to talk to people.
Awesome. I'm going to put all that in the show notes. Again, my guest has been John Devlin. He's the author of True Colors Football Kits from 1980s, net from 1980 to the present day, volumes 1 and 2, and he runs the True Colors Football Kits website. John, thanks again. We will talk soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Austin. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the Soccer Nomad podcast. Let me know what you think by commenting on the Podomatic page or giving the show a review and rating on iTunes. And help me spread the word by sharing this podcast with a fellow soccer fan. You can follow me on Twitter at AustinLong1974, and please visit my blog, soccernomad.wordpress.com, for posts on kits, memories, and more. Thanks again.